You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 8 days into the month of April. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe, and on today's show, an interview with autistic self-advocate and AAC user Darla on COVID-19-related language accessibility for nonverbal people, as well as audio from the Cinema Politica panel discussion for the film When We Walk by Jason De Silva. All that and more right here on CKUT 9.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca, or follow us on Twitter at @avalancheckut. Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. First up on today's show, an interview with Darla, who is an autistic self-advocate and AAC user, on language accessibility during the COVID-19 crisis and how it impacts nonverbal people. That's up now.
Okay, so hello, welcome to the show. Would you be able to introduce yourself to the audience?
My name is Darla. I am an autistic self-advocate and AAC user from Ottawa, Canada. I work as an e-learning specialist and freelance editor and technical writer. I am also a member of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Group, A4A, and have been involved in some of our presentations to community groups.
So what is AAC?
AAC stands for Augmentative and Alternative Communication, which is a very proverbial long mouthful of a phrase. AAC is essentially any method used to communicate which is not mouth speech. Most often it is using either a specialized app or device, a board, or a book of symbols or letters. In high-tech AAC, the user selects symbols corresponding to words or phrases, or types on a keyboard, and the program will read what we say out loud. In low-tech forms, like a letter board or a book of symbols, the person will point or indicate via eye gaze which they mean and a communication partner will interpret them. For example, I use two different apps for Apple devices, Perloco Tugo and Perloco for text, which are made by a Dutch company called Assistiveware. Perloco Tugo uses symbols, so if I want to order a large black coffee I might touch the symbols for I would like a large black and coffee, and then I would have the device speak my message. But I mostly use Perloco for text, which is a text-to-speech app. It also lets me type and store messages and responses, so I can prepare what I will say at a meeting or appointment beforehand and play it when I need to. But everyone uses some form of AAC. Text or instant messaging, Facebook posts, even sending memes is a form of AAC. Some people also use sign language, although there is some contention in calling it AAC as it is the primary language of the deaf community and thus is not an alternative.
So what has been developed to aid those using AAC to communicate about COVID-19?
The level of support coming from the AAC community overall has been just fantastic. One company, CoughDrop, expanded their trial period to 4 months so that people who used the app on a device owned by a school or day program could remain connected with their support teams. Assistiveware has started organizing video chats, some for families, some for adult users, to keep people connected and help maintain community. Nonprofits like Communication Disabilities Access Canada and the International Society for AAC, ISAC, have been putting out a lot of materials to assist there. Disabled self-advocacy groups have been doing some amazing work writing clear language explanations and suggestions of what to do and how to cope.
Do you feel that the accessibility measures regarding language have been adequately shared to those needing them?
That is a really good question. And I am honestly not sure. The issue with any disability advocacy is that it always transmits well within a limited circle, but outside of those circles things get more complicated. With that said, groups like CDAC and ISAC have done phenomenal jobs communicating with their members. So, I guess I hope that they are getting shared far enough, but I worry that there will always be communities, especially since many resources are just produced in English, which are not reached.
And have Canada's governments or international bodies like the World Health Organization released information for AAC, or has it primarily been created by the community that uses them?
It's been pretty much entirely coming from the AAC community. I don't think I have seen anything from WHO or Health Canada or the like specifically speaking to AAC user.
And what are the benefits of these softwares being community sourced? And how can official information be beneficial?
Tough question. So, the benefit of working with the AAC community is the same as any software developer working with their user base. We help identify major issues and changes that would help us the most. For instance, many of us need to make phone calls for things like medical appointments, but don't always have someone else to make the call for us. So Assistiveware recently added a feature to their apps which lets them interface with the phone function of iPads and iPhones so that what you type is heard by the person you are speaking with. This has been a game changer, especially during social distancing and isolation where we cannot visit friends or loved ones, let alone our doctors or therapists.
What needs to be implemented to ensure proper care for those requiring AAC should they contract coronavirus?
That is a scary question. First, all AAC devices and objects need to be cleaned thoroughly, as they are high-touch, high-contact items, meaning they can be vectors for the virus to spread. AAC users may require more communication support, as being sick and feverish makes communication harder. For me, for example, when I am sick I have a lot more trouble with motor planning, and I stim a lot more. So I will use a simple app like Perloco Tugo because typing is harder. We may also see otherwise abled people benefit from AAC use because they are intubated or unable to speak due to coughing. Everyone benefits from wider AAC access during these situations. But COVID is also a real threat to the AAC community because so many people with communication disabilities are often in other high-risk groups. They may have other conditions which weaken their immune systems, or have a greater tendency towards respiratory illness or infection, or a greater difficulty with maintaining hand hygiene due to physical or developmental disability.
Do hospitals already have AAC software available? Should people needing the technology be hospitalized due to COVID-19 symptoms?
Honestly, the state of AAC in hospitals has been very haphazard. There is not a lot of education about AAC use, especially from individuals who are independent or not visibly physically disabled. There is a huge issue in the medical community where care providers speak to support workers or parents instead of the disabled patient. There have also been cases where people's devices have been taken away from them for various reasons that amounted to ignorance of what a device is for or what a person is capable of for communication. There is very little direct training on AAC use, and if it comes from any department, it generally comes from the speech-language pathologists, and hospitals generally will not be providing the software. At best, they might have some printed-off symbol or letter boards, but even that is very up in the air. This is especially bad for patients who are admitted for mental health issues, as they are very likely to have their device removed, especially if they have a record of any speech ability. Given that many autistic people who use AAC may also have mental health problems, this is a huge issue.
What are other accessibility concerns during this pandemic for nonverbal or minimally verbal people?
The biggest accessibility concern, and fear, is this: if I go into the hospital full of unfamiliar people, will they respect my communication? Will I be allowed to keep my device? Will my competence be presumed, or will they infantilize me and treat me like a child? Will I be allowed to make medical decisions for myself? Another issue is that describing my body and what is going on inside it is very difficult for me, and for many others. If I suspect I have COVID, will a doctor or nurse take that seriously? Will I be able to speak with someone over the phone who will understand my device? These concerns are very real, and a lot of people are grappling with them, but I am unsure how best to deal with them. One thing I do recommend is that AAC users and / those supporting them come up with a plan for hospitalization. Have a fully written up list documenting disability, medications, necessary equipment, how to best communicate with us, etc. I have seen some great resources for this from groups like CDAC, and I have a lot of stuff programmed into my device should I be hospitalized to help there also.
Do you feel that the government has done enough to protect disabled lives during this pandemic?
In Canada, I think there is more awareness of it, but people are also seeing what is happening in places like Italy and America, where hospitals are publicly stating that they essentially do not value the lives of disabled people as much as those of abled. Hospitals in America are saying that they will confiscate medically necessary ventilators from disabled people who are hospitalized, even if it's not related to COVID-19 and the person has a good chance of surviving. This is going to reduce the trust that the disabled community places in hospitals. There is also the issue that while many Canadians are receiving financial help, financial supports for disabled Canadians have not gone up in years. And yet disabled people who cannot work are still expected to pay increasing rent and inflated prices as food and medical supply costs continue to rise. I worry what may happen in Canada, and I would like to see our government speak out clearly in support of its disabled citizens. Disabled lives are already undervalued by the medical system, and we must act to ensure that disabled children and adults are not sacrificed in the name of expediency. I am not an ODSP, but my friends who are on it are definitely feeling a lot of distress right now over it. However, I don't think we will see much change there, as the Ford government in Ontario, and Kenny in Alberta, have been pretty clear that they don't think disabled people deserve much, or deserve the life well. I would hope that we would see payments increase, but I don't have a lot of confidence there.
So what can governments do to better protect disabled lives during the COVID-19 crisis?
Aside from making a clear statement to the value of disabled lives, governments need to put more money into the welfare systems that support so many disabled people who are not able to work. There needs to be more supports around shopping, such as stores having specific times for disabled and elderly people to shop. There also needs to be an understanding and flexibility in disability policy, because disability does not fit well into a single uniform box. People have different needs, and so disability policy needs to be wide and flexible.
And how can listeners learn more about AAC?
I would recommend checking out groups like Communication Disabilities Access Canada, the International Society for AAC, and advocacy groups like Communication First, A4A Ontario, and the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network.
And how can listeners support your work?
I don't have any specific projects I am working on right now to promote. But I urge all listeners to remain indoors, only go out for necessities, and to maintain social distancing. Please, take precautions, wash your hands, keep your contact with other people limited. This will last for a while, but then it will be over. But only if we work hard to flatten the curve and minimize the spread now. I know it is hard, but there are many people, many of my friends, whose lives depend on bringing this virus under control.
All right, it was really nice talking to you.
You too. Have a great night, and stay safe.
Breathe in, breathe out. The future is a game for us. Never plays out the way it was. I believe it now. But when a tide turns on me, turns against me, and I fall, fall into the unknown, where I have been before. All I want is to go on. I swear that I can make it go. I keep trying to hold on to my love with no control. When I keep on calling, you left me with no warning. Now I'm still waiting for you. All love with no control, no control, no control, no control. And I don't see why. Price we have to higher on the way back up. When we're living now. But when a tide turns on me, turns against me, and I fall, fall into the unknown, nowhere I have been before. All I want is to go on. I swear that I can make it go. I keep trying to hold on to my
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to an interview with Darla, an autistic self-advocate and AAC user, on language accessibility during the COVID-19 crisis. Up next, audio from a cinema political discussion panel for the film When We Walk by Jason Da Silva. The panel, facilitated by Ezra from Cinema Politica, featured Gift Tsuma and Amy Lau, who are Montreal-based activists, in a discussion on Jason's new film, When We Walk. The full audio of this event can be found on Cinema Politica's Facebook page.
Jason Da Silva has been a prolific filmmaker for the past 20 years. He has directed 4 short films and 4 feature-length documentaries, lest we forget From the Mouthpiece on Back, When We Walk. Olivia's Puzzle, a short, premiered at the 2003 Sundance Festival and also qualified for an Academy Award. 3 of his films have had national broadcasts on PBS, HBO, and CBC. Da Silva's film, When I Walk, won a 2015 Emmy Award for Outstanding Informational Programming, was an official selection at the Sundance Film Festival, and won Best Canadian Feature at Hot Docs. In 2014, Jason also won 3 awards: the AAPD Mobility Magazine's Person of the Year, the Paul E. Hearn Leadership Award, and the Christopher Award for Excellence in Film. His latest feature film is When We Walk, which premiered at Hot Docs in 2019. Amy Lowe is a writer and producer living in Jaujigai, Montreal, unceded Mohawk territory. Her master's in media studies at Concordia University led her to specialize in disability journalism and production. Now freelancing for CBC Radio and The Walrus, among others, Amy takes a conversational and uncompromising approach to writing, using personal stories to point to broad-reaching social issues. Combining this writing with systems change work, Amy works with clients like educational institutions, art organizations, and city departments, offering consultation and training on culture change and accessibility. Her book, Less Sweet Than Chocolate or Concrete, great title, with Frog Hollow Press, is coming out this year. Gif Tsuma is a disability rights activist and music composer with a background in sociology and a minor in law and society from Concordia University. Over the past decade, he has been heavily involved in advocacy for disability rights and accessibility issues in Montreal. As a co-founding member of a grassroots group, Accessibilize Montreal, he has been involved in numerous initiatives targeting discriminatory infrastructure, both physical and social, that excludes people with diverse bodies and minds from public spaces and stigmatizes them. He currently holds positions at the Office for Students with Disabilities at McGill University and at the Center for Gender Advocacy at Concordia University. For the past 5 years, Gift has been working as an advisor in accessibility and universal design. Gift carries a wealth of experience in the nonprofit, health, public, technical, and service sectors. He is committed to social justice issues and in the empowerment of marginalized communities. Thank you all for joining us. On a last note, I'll say that all 3 of you have been at Cinema Politica in the real world, non-virtually, at our screenings. And so it's really nice to see everybody again and be reunited. Okay, Jason, When We Walk is a follow-up to your equally powerful 2013 documentary, When I Walk. Can you talk about the germination for the earlier film, the relationship between the two, and the process for you of making films that are so deeply personal for such a wide public?
Yeah, thanks. So yeah, so the first part, what led to When I Walk, was really coming to, so because I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when I was 25. I've been working as a documentary filmmaker for all that time, but I didn't know how to function really as being a creator and being a person with a disability and having to, you know, I made a lot of films about other subjects, but I didn't make a film about myself up until then. So When I Walk was really me coming to understanding and how to properly explain what I was going through to my audience, or really to people that were going to be seeing me. I wanted to do that on screen. But it was also me and myself coming to understanding. what I was going through as well. So second part of the question. So the relationship between when I walk and when we walk. So when I work in these films that take a long time. So think about it, it's like cinema verite documentary films that are, so it's kind of like films like Grey Garden. So I work in the Maisels Brothers format. So we tend to shoot a lot, and have lots of footage. So at the end of the film, I have terabytes of footage, and I just choose what I would like. So in When I Walk, I did have 40 terabytes of footage. When We Walk, I had another 40 terabytes of footage. So it's trying to find the story amongst each of those. So the relationship with When I Walk, where I was coming to terms with my own disability, and When We Walk is really coming to terms with not my own disability, but how I'm going to continue living life with my son not being in my life. So that was really the premise behind When I Walk and trying to find When We Walk, sorry, and trying to find a way to be in his life. Then the third part of that question, I forget it now. What was the third part of that?
Oh, just if you can speak about the process for you of making films that are so deeply personal, but then are shared with such a huge, wide public.
Yeah, that's right. So it really is something, it's very difficult to make films like this that are so intensely personal, but somehow I managed to do it. I think that whatever has happened, I go through therapy, and the making of the film is in a way a form of therapy for me. So even though the relationship, the story is about something that is so deeply personal, I'm able to use the medium as a way to confront what I'm going through in both When I Walk and When We Walk.
Okay, thank you. Well, we all benefit enormously from those 40 terabytes of did you say 40?
Yeah, 40 terabytes.
From the good parts that you've carved off of that 40 terabytes to share with us. And I think it's really amazing that you made yourself so vulnerable to so many strangers as well in both films. So thank you for that. The second question I wanted to ask is, in When We Walk, you're forced to move to a state in which your child doesn't live so that you can access more affordable personal care and healthcare, obviously. Has your situation changed in that regard? And relatedly, maybe you can tell us what the current landscape of disability activism is like right now in the US?
The first part, sadly to say, but things have not changed. So I'm living in New York. My son lives in Texas with his mother. And with the current state, so with the coronavirus and all the challenges that we're all facing, I don't know when the next time that I'm going to be able to see my son is. So I'm really glad to have this film to share with him. But I will say that it's really, really sad for me. And I think he's coming to understand how difficult this is going to be, but it's going to be a long time before I see him again. So we talk online, but there's nothing like just seeing your son and being with them physically. And this time is, so just talking like these video calls are great, but they are challenging for a son and his father to be together during this time.
Most of us are north of the 49th parallel here, and Canada.
Right.
We're just wondering about what the current landscape of disability activism looks like in the U.S.
Yeah, so especially right now during this time, it's really, really dark. So just people, it really, so me being here in New York City, It is really scary. So I'm working with, my nonprofit organization is called Access Lab. So we're trying to do work giving people with disabilities access to media and technology. But I will say that it's a dark time where we're just trying to get the story about people's needs out there. And if nothing else, this is a really difficult time that goes to show how challenging the U.S. society is to be a person with a disability in it.
Jason, I really enjoyed your film very much. I've seen the first one as well when I walk, and it was interesting just to see the continuation from where you left off to where things are right now. And I know, like, in the introduction of the film, it looks like it's like an open letter to your son. I was also wondering, like, who else this film is dedicated to, or what else were you hoping, or are you hoping to achieve, if you haven't already, through this specific film?
So yeah, that's a good question. So one thing I really wanted to do, so it is an open letter to my son, but it is a way to speak to the Medicaid policy and the inconsistencies of Medicaid throughout the 50 states. So I was sitting in New York that they get 24-hour care, but in Texas, I would be living in the nursing home. And during this time, I'm really glad that I'm here in New York, because the last thing I'd want to be doing right now is living in a nursing home where you can't have social distance and be away from other people, because it's almost like being in a jail in a way. Being around other people, it's difficult to keep your distance. So I'm glad that I'm in New York. But I will say that, like, that's the one thing that this film really brought to light for me, is how different it is in other parts of the states, but in each and every state. So you can rank the states from 1 to 50 for their Medicaid support and their treatment of people with disabilities as well.
And, like, through when you were deciding to move to Texas, were there other options that you were thinking of exploring other than the long-term nursing home, like, let's say, a care collective sort of situation? I'm just curious what other options you were weighing out that may not necessarily had come out in the film.
I mean, there is, like, the option of living with a lot of maybe for people in a group setting, so groups are kids, group care setting, but my level of really needs, I need to have somebody 24/7, but it's partly because I wouldn't be able to make the films or have the same amount of freedoms that I would have if I was living here or someplace else. So I wouldn't be able to be a thriving filmmaker or anything like that if I was living there in a nursing home or group home setting.
And I know, like, most of your films, they're very personal. I'm just wondering, like, in terms of, like, since the second film, was about your marriage and your son, how was that process like for you to figure out what sort of lens or how personal you should get, and how you were navigating that between you and your ex-wife in terms of, like, how much to reveal to the world and how much not to reveal? Because I know there were some scenes that were very intimate and very moving, and I'm just wondering how you navigated that between the two of you.
Yeah, it's a good question. So the answer to that is I don't have an answer to that, because she stopped talking to me. So from the moment that she left for Texas, it was impossible to even carry that conversation with her. So I just created the film. So it was like a one-sided film in a way. So I realized that I had the responsibility to make it as virtuous as possible, I'd say. So I tried to not put her in a bad light or anything like that. So it's almost like, if one of the subjects in your film just left, how do you still make a film that's two-sided? So I just, I did do a lot of work with different psychologists and things like that to make sure that I was portraying her in the best light.
Great. Well, thanks again for making this film, Jason, and for sharing, I don't know, like your reflections and your experiences. I know that it's certainly probably a conversation starter for a lot of people, so I really appreciate it. One thing that came to mind for me, like as someone who's also made films and does a lot of writing related to, yeah, just like experiences of disability and also like structural barriers, I grapple with the balancing act of presenting like a disability positive perspective for people who I know already have a lot of ableist ideas, and then also wanting to balance that with, you know, real frustrations or difficulties or the more emotional side of living in a non-normative body, I guess. And so I wanted to know if you had thoughts on like that balancing act or how you navigated that with this film.
The only way to do that, it's I really think that it's by feedback, and not just feedback from all audience members, but it specifically needs to be feedback from the disability community or people that are being affected by the same issues in the film. So I did a lot of Q&A testing. So in a software engineer program way, it's called QA, QC. So question answer testing. So there was just a lot of testing that I did before I could even put the film out. I wanted to make sure that all answers, so I had a lot of feedback sessions with people before I could even release the film to the audience.
Was it mostly people with MS or like different disability communities?
So different disability communities, but also women's groups as well. Women's groups as well, and different minority communities, so disability and not disability as well. So it was like I was really holding meetings of maybe 4 or 5 meetings of 15 people each, and just go around and ask questions and get people to write comments, things like that. So I did that all of summer of the year before last.
Yeah. Okay. That's nice to have a structure to get feedback. That's cool.
It's really important, I think, especially when you're dealing with sensitive topics. Like, even though it's a personal story and I could tell the story and put it out there to the world, it's only accurate if you're responsible enough to really get feedback from potential audience members. And I think that's one thing I would say to other filmmakers out there. It's just, it's crucial to get feedback from people. So if you don't do that already, please do, because it really serves your film well. I remember even, so my very first film in like 1999, I went to Emily Carr in Vancouver. And I remember at Emily Carr, it's like I was editing the film, and then I was showing the film like every weekend and every chance I get to get feedback from people. And I think it took like a whole year in getting feedback till I could get feedback and realize that I liked the way that it was. I didn't have to do it certain ways. So it is really important.
I have another kind of like question about what you decided to show, kind of along the lines that Ezra asked, but I noticed that in some scenes you show how you set the cameras up and how you recruit like people like your dad in certain scenes to set the camera up right, and like you're kind of incorporating him into the process. Yeah. And is that kind of like a shout out to other artists being like, this is how I do it, or like what's your reasoning for including those types of scenes?
So I, you know, what it comes down to is because I'm actually not a filmmaker by practice, so I'm actually a performance artist. So I studied Emily Carr being an installation artist and a performance artist. And because of that, I believe that the process is as important as the product. So I really believe in incorporating the process of making the film into the product, so the final film, just because it gives viewers and especially other filmmakers, gives them insight into how to make a film under such strange circumstances. Like, how can a filmmaker that can't hold the camera make a film? It's with help from others and help from his father to try and operate the camera and things like that. I just think it's and it makes things fun too.
Yeah, I mean, it comes off as really personable, I think, and I don't know. I think it's like nice modeling for other crip artists, even in different fields, you know, to be like, so this is how I do it. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think that it's something that people need to not fully take seriously, because it's just a medium. Film is just a medium, and we can control it any way that we want to. So yeah, it's important for other artists, especially other crip artists and other artists with disabilities, to be able to tell the stories and craft film and storytelling the way that they see fit.
I just wanted to ask you all this question, actually, all three of you, because you are all media makers, whether it's music, films, Amy's got a book coming out, writing. And the question is, we're right now, have never had, I don't mean right this necessarily this moment during the pandemic, although it's certainly heightened, but in our current era, never before have so many people had so much access to so much media. And during this pandemic, many people who are privileged enough to be able to access media are accessing it. There is this idea of the attention economy, how there's so much that there's almost too much. And so I'm wondering if you can speak to that as artists about what drives you to keep making it. Jason, you mentioned process, but also impact, but then also overcoming this idea of finding audiences for the media that you're all involved in making.
Well, I think that there is so much content out in the world. And also I'm still, like, I grew up super hungry for stories about anyone who I resonated with. Like, so maybe I'm aging myself here, but like any queer stories, any stories about girls with disabilities, like I just didn't really experience those. I didn't take those in. I don't think they were supported, and I don't think that they were out there in the same way that other stories were. So for me, that's still a big motivation. Like, I don't feel threatened by the other content that's available. And I also think that having had a start on like a blog and having like web resources available has certainly allowed me as an artist to connect with a whole lot of other like crip community that has only just emboldened my own practice.
Like, for example, with my music, it's soul music, it's gospel music. And like, I grew up around the church where like gospel music was at the forefront. And there were not too many people who looked like me, who had a disability and were Black, except for Stevie Wonder, of course. And that was the only person I could think of within the mainstream media who I could relate to. I mean, excuse me, I know Ray Charles is out there, but he was not in my radar considering my taste and style of music. But I'd say like this year of having access to media and how it's been heightened has actually opened a lot of doors for me in terms of how I express music. And also meeting other disabled artists as well, like through Blurring the Boundaries and Drake Music, where like they work on adapted music, accessible music, and how to create expression in different ways. So I think like the advancement of access to media and technology has been, in my view, a positive.
Yeah, I feel the same. Both you guys said it. So I think this is a really interesting time where our stories, all stories, can be, it's just not been done before. So I think in the past 30 years, I think, and more so in like, so as technology gets better and better, our stories can be put out there, and they weren't being put out there before. So I think we are at the forefront. So there would have been no way that I could have told my story maybe 20 years ago. But now with the way technology is, it's crazy that I can finish a film and film 40 terabytes of footage, and I can have this story being told. And yeah, the stories need to be told. So I think if you have the energy, I think tell the stories, because they need to exist.
Thank you all for those answers. And I guess a bit of a follow-up, just building off of what all three of you spoke of, because you talked about community, about seeing yourself or hearing yourself or reading about yourself in the media. And that's an issue of underrepresentation. And I guess that reminds me, and then Jason obviously talking, well, all of you talking about the importance of storytelling. And then this is all deeply connected to self-representation. And this is a big subject in the documentary film world, for instance, who gets to tell whose stories and who traditionally has told the stories about other people's lived experiences. And this has been a big debate going on here in Canada for the last several years. And I know it's going on in the US as well, Jason. And I wanted to just talk about, if you could all talk about this idea of telling your own stories from your own lived experience and this idea of self-representation. If there is a pressure, whether it's internal or external, to always make that story about disability, because for instance, Jason, I know your films are much more than about that. Of course, they're also very much about that, but they're also about your interpersonal relationships. They're about you looking very inward and being self-reflexive of the human being that you are and the things that you're going through as a person in the world. So yeah, I guess I just, because there's something called the burden of representation and this idea that you are representing for a community and what that means every time. And I'm wondering if there is that, if you feel, any of you feel that pressure ever, or if it's just like not there?
As an artist, I always feel that pressure, because it's like you have access to this platform where you're expressing yourself, and you just want to make sure that you are not coming off as like, this is how the disability community looks like. This is just me. And that's always very difficult within the art scene, because the general public has their own perception of what a disabled artist is supposed to do and what should they represent, right? Which brings up to the whole narrative of like inspiration porn, right? Where like you could be an average artist and you are viewed as the groundbreaking artist. And I can tell you, like, I'm not an impressive artist by any margin. I'm an average artist. I can sing, I can hold a note. But am I Stevie Wonder? Absolutely not. Do I wish I was? Absolutely yes. And there is always that pressure where you're accepting the compliments, you're accepting the comments, and you're trying to say like, okay, I thank you for those comments, but this is where I am. This is where you think I am. I'm just a regular guy playing music. I'm nothing special. I didn't reinvent, I didn't create a genre. I just rode the wheel that has already been created. There's always that pressure, and it stresses me out more than the performance itself.
I've got something to say on this. So yeah, like when it comes to the stresses to fit within the mold as a person with a disability, I think that the reason why I wanted this film to be out there in its natural form is as compared to When I Walk, this film really just turned everything as to the expectation of what would be going on in my life and just turned it on its head completely. So I wanted to say a person with a disability can separate from somebody, can have a kid which goes 2,000 miles away and still survive, or not survive, but thankfully I survive. But so what I'm saying is these stories are really important to be told in all shapes and forms. So it's important to be able to tell the stories and not live in the stereotype of what a person with a disability should be like. We're really opening the form up a little bit and telling stories more than just what the expectations are.
Subverting expectation is definitely a good, or like a logical response to being kind of in a box. I generally, at least in the last few years, have been really allergic to any sort of like representation. Like I've completely pushed any sort of like generalizations about what I write or provide, like share with people, to almost an extreme where I'm like, I'm literally only talking about myself in these conditions as who I am. And so I've almost come to like over describe who I am, because I'm like, I'm talking about really specific conditions. I'm not talking about disability experience or whatnot. And so now I'm somewhere in the middle where I'm like, okay, I do have analysis that speaks to certain structural barriers that we might share. And then also like a personal experience that nobody else has because I'm an individual. So it's a balancing act, Ezra. I don't really have a response. I think it's just like one of those lifelong things where you do what feels right at the time. And also, you know, bringing on other people into discussions. So not always, like sometimes just sharing what platform we have with our friends and people who are different from us too.
We'd be remiss to not mentioned the current situation. And I'm wondering if anyone has any thoughts on the ways in which the current health pandemic affects people differently, or how it's affected you all in your current situations. You know, there's a lot of people posting videos of being agonized because they have to stay in their homes for 2 weeks, which hardly seems like much of a sacrifice in the greater scheme of things. So I'm just wondering how it is obviously a global health pandemic, and it is related to this idea of public health. So if there's anything you want to say about either the situation or just on the topic of public health, because I think if one thing is coming out of this, a lot of people are suddenly talking about public health who weren't even thinking of it before.
I can speak to personal experience where like the hours of care that I receive have been affected tremendously due to the pandemic, where like the hours are reducing or people are unable to show up to the shifts anymore to assist, and we are having to navigate and reconfigure your life basically at that instant on that day where you don't have much of a notice. And this has led me to wonder and think whether caregiving will change its form than what we currently know it as. And I'd like to throw even that question to Jason and Amy, just to hear your perspective on like, what could care look like in a pandemic or 50 years from now? Is it gonna be the way we see it right now? How is it gonna be affected? Because I'm already seeing the effects and we've only been 3 to 4 weeks in.
I think Giff was mentioning, throwing it out to Amy and Jason, if either of you want to.
For the better, but even after this pandemic is over, I don't know how much, hopefully it's a wake-up call, and it will change for the better, but the powers that be might not be, they might just change, go back to the way it was again. That's my ultimate worry, that it would just not change that much.
I think the wage increase that the federal government announced for personal support workers and other people in the caregiving fields is like a small way into further increasing their wages and like making their working conditions better. And so, but it seems like any improvement will take a lot of activism and support from a lot of people, because like, yeah.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to audio from a panel discussion hosted by Cinepolitica Concordia on the topic of the film When We Walk by Jason De Silva. If you would like to hear the remainder of this discussion panel, you can find that on Cinepolitica Concordia's Facebook page. That completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you'd like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalanche@ckut.ca. or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news@ckut.ca. Stay tuned. Hersey's up next.
If your last vaccination against COVID-19 was more than 5 months ago, it's time to get another dose. Boosting your antibodies reduces the risk of getting or transmitting the virus, and booster doses help reduce the number of hospitalizations and deaths related to COVID-19. For better protection against the virus, book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine and follow the recommended vaccination schedule. Vaccination against COVID-19, a good way of extending our protection. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The words mental illness, what do you think?
I have friends who don't even know that I suffer from depression.
Why don't they know?
Because I'm scared they'll ostracize me if they know, and then they'll abandon me. I don't want to be alone.
You're discriminated against when you have a mental illness. With other illnesses, there's compassion.
It doesn't take much to be diagnosed mentally ill.
Due to an outburst, I was diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. And now the doctors say it's something else.
20% of people and counting have had or will have a depression.
People throw different labels around. You are this or you are that.
Everybody psychoanalyzes someone during a conversation.
You have a right to express emotions.
Anger, love, hate, sadness, confusion. It does not mean you're ill.
If you're down and out, seek help. Don't be scared. It can be very intimidating.
There are people listening and willing to help.
We have to innovate.
Get informed. Contact your local CLSC, Sun Youth, AMI Quebec, Ford House, or Prevention Suicide.
You're listening to In the Motherhood here on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's May 18th, just a bit past 6 p.m., and I'm your host for today, Robin Fadden. We have two pieces of content today on In the Motherhood, and the first half is an interview I just did with the author and journalist Tara Schwartz about her new book, Can't Help Falling, A Long Road to Motherhood, and it's a memoir. It was recently published by Linda Leith Publishing here in Montreal, and I'll put that link on our Facebook page, the CKUT-In the Motherhood Facebook page. In this memoir, Tara recounts her unexpected emotional and inspiring journey to motherhood, as the book title implies. She was a longtime news reporter and spent years working in front of the television camera, of course, and telling other people's stories, and this time she is telling her own. I'll get into that interview right now. Thanks for listening to CKUT. Hi, Tara. Welcome to In the Motherhood. It's really great to talk to you.
Hello, Robin. Thank you so much for having me on.
Your book, Can't Help Falling, A Long Road to Motherhood, tells your story with such raw emotion and compassion for yourself and your family, your